Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Right.
Okay, so with the official disclaimer out of the way, I want to welcome you to today's deep dive. Today, our mission is to unpack a really massive stack of recent intelligence reports and defense analysis spanning July 2026.
Yeah, there is a lot of ground to cover.
Exactly. We are looking at updates from the Institute for the Study of War, Breaking Defense, and the War Zone. And the overarching theme we are tracking today is a snapshot of a world that is, you know, rapidly redefining how wars are fought.
Mm.
We are going to connect the dots between global flashpoints looking at area responsibility reporting from the Middle East, Ukraine, NATO, and the Indo-Pacific. Before we jump into the weeds, can you give us the operational BLUF?
Yeah, absolutely. Here is your bottom line up front. The operational environment in July 2026 indicates a complete erosion of traditional military boundaries, driven by asymmetric technologies and the weaponization of civilian infrastructure. Adversarial nations are now heavily sharing sensitive capabilities across theaters in an attempt to overextend Western defenses. Consequently, U.S. and allied forces are being forced to adapt to a landscape where everything from commercial drone boats to everyday home Wi-Fi networks is an active vector for conflict.
Right. So the tactical playbooks are just completely changing.
Essentially, yes.
Well, let's start by looking at where those playbooks are probably burning the fastest right now, which is the Middle East, specifically the Strait of Hormuz. Because based on the recent reporting, the U.S.-Iran ceasefire has effectively ended.
Yeah, it is completely evaporated at this point.
Right. And looking at the situation strictly impartially, the U.S. administration has reimposed a full naval blockade on Iranian ports. This follows a pretty serious intensification of strikes in the region. And the stated U.S. policy here is basically to apply economic pressure until Iran halts its aggressive maritime actions.
Exactly. And, you know, on the other side of that equation, Iran has drawn some very firm red lines of their own. They are outright refusing to negotiate any aspect of their nuclear program.
That includes the Talaqin II facility, right?
The Talaqin II site, which is deeply buried and heavily fortified. They will not negotiate on that unless the U.S. explicitly recognizes Iranian control over the Strait of Hormuz.
Wow.
Yeah. For Tehran, I mean, the Strait isn't just a waterway. It is their primary strategic choke point. It's their ultimate leverage against the West.
It is essentially the world's most dangerous geopolitical toll booth.
That is a very good way to put it, yeah.
But looking at the intelligence, the Iranian leadership isn't exactly a monolith here. There is some serious internal friction playing out.
Right? Oh, absolutely. It is highly fractured.
Because you have the new Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, who reportedly wants to accept the June 18 Memorandum of Understanding. He's looking at the crushing weight of this reinstated U.S. blockade and realizes he needs a deal to save their economy.
Right. He is acting from a position of civilian pragmatism.
But then you have Supreme Leader Mojtaba Khamenei and the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who flatly refused to surrender the strait. So let me just reason through this impartially, because it feels a bit contradictory.
Okay.
If the Iranian president wants a deal to save their economy from the blockade, why are they still actively firing missiles? I mean, how does shooting at things help lift an economic blockade?
Right. Well, it's because the Iranian president doesn't actually control the trigger.
Okay.
The IRGC operates almost as a parallel state. They answer directly to the supreme leader, so they hold the monopoly on kinetic military force. While the civilian diplomats might be looking for an economic off-ramp, the IRGC is perfectly willing to absorb that economic pain if it means enforcing their control over the strait.
Which explains the recent strikes.
Exactly. They are retaliating by striking U.S. facilities across Bahrain, Kuwait, Jordan, Qatar, and Oman. And simultaneously, they are running aggressive deterrence campaigns against Gulf states like the UAE.
Basically warning them not to cooperate with the U.S. blockade.
Precisely.
And the U.S. is responding on two fronts. Economically, they are sanctioning shadow banks linked directly to Supreme Leader Khamenei, like the Dubai-based Smart Global Limited.
Mm-hmm.
But the military response is where we are seeing actual history being made. Because on July 12, for the first time in U.S. military history, uncrewed surface vessels, USVs, were used as strike weapons in active combat against Iranian targets.
Yeah, this is a monumental shift in naval doctrine. The U.S. deployed Saronic Corsair kamikaze drone boats.
Right.
To really understand why this matters, you have to look at the traditional math of naval combat. For decades, if you wanted to strike a coastal target, you had to risk a multi-billion dollar destroyer and the lives of hundreds of sailors.
Which is an incredibly high risk-to-reward ratio for an asymmetric threat.
Exactly. The Saronic Corsair flips that math completely. These are, you know, highly maneuverable, low-profile, uncrewed boats. They are packed with explosives.
So they are cheap and expendable.
Right. And most importantly, they remove human operators from the line of fire entirely.
Which provides a really perfect transition to the Russian offensive campaign and the situation in Ukraine. Because while the U.S. military is just now crossing the threshold of using these kamikaze drone boats in combat, Ukraine has essentially written the modern doctrine on it.
Oh, without a doubt. They have mastered asymmetric naval warfare.
Right. They have launched this massive campaign to isolate occupied Crimea.
Yeah.
And their primary focus right now is strangling Russian logistics in the Sea of Azov.
The numbers coming out of there are just staggering.
I know. Since July 6, Ukrainian forces have struck 90 Russian oil tankers.
Mm-hmm.
90. I read in the ISW reports that they hit 21 tankers in a single night between July 10th and July 11th.
Yeah, the coordination required for that is immense.
But let me push back on this a little bit.
Mm.
Is blowing up oil tankers actually going to stop the Russian army on the ground? Or is this just, you know, economic harassment?
No, it translates immediately to the battlefield. This is acute, real-time fuel starvation for the military.
Okay, how so?
Think about the logistics of a frontline division. Tanks, armored personnel carriers, the supply trucks bringing in artillery shells. Every single piece of that machinery burns diesel at an astonishing rate.
Right.
So by shutting down the sea lanes, they forced Russia to halt navigation on the Donezov Canal and the Kerch Strait. Ukraine is severing the actual arteries of the Russian war machine. If you can't move fuel, your tanks become very expensive stationary metal boxes.
Wow. And they're compounding this by hitting the major refineries deep inside Russia, right?
Yes. Places like Norsai, Omsk, and the Saratov refinery. Russian domestic gasoline production has plummeted to 65% of their seasonal demand.
That is a massive drop. And we are seeing simultaneous overnight strikes around July 12 and 13 hitting crucial transport ferries like the Yisk and the Lavrentiy, as well as patrol boats and radar stations across Crimea and Krasnodar Krai.
And when you combine that fuel starvation with these localized tactical strikes, you see the momentum shift on the ground.
But wait, speaking of tactical strikes, there's a detail in this stack of reports that sounds like science fiction.
You were talking about the Kinburn Spit.
Yes. We just talked about drone boats blowing up tankers.
Yeah.
But on the Kinburn Spit, Ukraine used a drone boat for something entirely different. They used it to land an armed, uncrewed robot directly onto a Russian-held beach.
It is brilliant from a tactical standpoint. Historically, amphibious landings are a commander's worst nightmare, right? The surf zone is where troops are most exposed to enemy fire.
Yeah, guys wading through water, totally vulnerable.
Exactly. So what Ukraine did was take a shallow draft drone boat and use it to deploy an autonomous ground combat vehicle directly into the hostile zone.
They turned what is historically a very deadly amphibious beach assault into a zero-casualty robotic raid.
Right. You are deploying heavy firepower without risking a single human life.
That is incredible. And these technological leaps seem to be translating to ground gains. General Sirsky reported that Ukraine recently liberated 120 square kilometers in the Oleksandrivka direction.
And he also noted that the Russian advance rate has been cut in half so far in 2026. The tactical assault ratio is now 40 to 60 favoring Ukraine.
Which is a big shift. And diplomatically, there was some major news. President Trump promised President Zelensky licenses to manufacture Patriot air defense interceptors inside Ukraine.
Right, which allows them to bypass international supply chain vulnerabilities entirely.
Right. But this brings us to section three of our deep dive, because there is a really fascinating paradox here. We just discussed autonomous robotic beach landings and localized advanced missile production in Ukraine. But when you look at how Russian intelligence is attempting to track these advanced weapons moving through NATO countries, their methods are shockingly low-tech.
Yeah, the doorbell espionage.
Exactly. Dutch intelligence revealed that Kremlin-based hackers have been spying on NATO military bases and supply routes by hacking into civilian doorbell cameras across Europe.
It is remarkably insidious, honestly. These hackers aren't trying to breach firewalled military networks. They are targeting the path of least resistance, the vulnerable firmware and default passwords of internet-connected cameras on everyday front porches in places like the Netherlands and Germany.
Right. So if your house happens to face a major highway leading to a military depot, your doorbell is suddenly a vital intelligence asset for the Russian military.
Exactly.
It's like Russia turned the Internet of Things into a dystopian, crowdsourced neighborhood watch.
That's a great analogy. They are just latching onto Western consumer conveniences to track the transport of weapons going to Ukraine.
But this is triggering a massive response from NATO.
Yeah.
8 NATO countries, Denmark, Canada, Finland, Germany, Norway, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Turkey, just announced a new mega constellation of satellites called HALO, Hybrid Alliance Layered Operations in Space. But let me ask you this. Does building a multi-billion dollar mega constellation in space actually solve the problem of a hacked doorbell in the Netherlands?
Well, no, it doesn't stop the hacker from looking through the camera, but what it does do is provide data sovereignty.
Okay, unpack that for me.
When local civilian infrastructure like internet routing centers or cellular towers is compromised, military commanders can't trust the data environment they are operating in. So HALO provides a secure, unhackable, high-speed transport layer entirely divorced from terrestrial networks. It bypasses the infected layer completely for high-speed comms and missile tracking.
Got it. And we are seeing a lot of investment here. Spain just became the 19th member of APSS, Allied Persistent Surveillance from Space, and its Aquila Virtual Intelligence Network.
Mm-hmm. And Turkey is spending over $300 million with TÜBİTAK to build two new high-resolution ISR satellites.
Okay, so NATO is tightening its alliances and its technological posture. But if we pivot to our final area of responsibility, the Indo-Pacific, we are seeing a mirror image of this exact same behavior among adversaries.
Arguably even more aggressive behavior.
Right. Let's look at China. The PLA just conducted a very rare test of a submarine-launched ballistic missile, an SLBM, in the South Pacific.
And this requires some serious context. The sources indicate this was likely a JL-3 or JL-2 missile fired from a Type 09IV submarine.
Which is a nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarine.
Right. By launching this missile, which splashed down between Tuvalu and Kiribati, China, is publicly demonstrating a highly credible nuclear second strike capability. They haven't publicly announced an SLBM test like this since 1982.
Wow, 1982.
Yeah. So Beijing is proving that they have the range and stealth to strike from the safety of their own regional waters.
And while they are doing that in the deep ocean, they are using a different tactic closer to home. The China Coast Guard is now implementing permanent patrols east of Taiwan.
This is a textbook execution of lawfare.
Lawfare, right. Using legal and administrative frameworks as a weapon because they were deploying Coast Guard vessels rather than Navy warships.
Exactly. It asserts civilian law enforcement jurisdiction over those waters.
So they're effectively laying the groundwork for a potential short-notice quarantine or blockade. But perhaps the most alarming intelligence from this theater involves covert military training.
Yes. The classified documents showing Russian Defense Minister Belousov personally approved the covert deployment of Russian forces to Beijing.
And this wasn't just basic infantry training. This was sensitive CBRN training, chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear warfare training.
When you have two major nuclear-armed states cooperating on the tactics and deployment of chemical and biological weapons, it represents an alarming level of military integration.
Right. And Russia isn't just relying on China. They are utilizing North Korea, too. Which brings us to the Korean Peninsula updates. North Korea is testing what the reports call diversified strike packages.
Right. Mixing tactical ballistic missiles, MLRS, and traditional howitzers all at the same time.
Just to overwhelm the processing power of U.S. and South Korean launch detection systems.
Precisely. It is a saturation tactic designed to confuse the automated intercept systems. And at the same time, North Korea is building a green water navy, preparing to commission a second destroyer, the Kangkon.
Which brings us to perhaps the most bizarre crossover of this entire deep dive.
Yeah.
South Korea and Ukraine are currently holding diplomatic talks regarding two North Korean prisoners of war.
Right, who are captured in Ukraine and now want to defect to South Korea.
It is surreal. Let me ask you to connect the final dots here for us. With China training Russians in chemical warfare and North Korean soldiers ending up as POWs in Ukraine, are we looking at a highly coordinated, unified adversary alliance, or is this just a series of opportunistic crimes of convenience?
Well, based on the reporting, it is a strategic entente, a deeply pragmatic partnership of convenience. They don't necessarily share a single governing ideology, but they share a unified strategic goal, diluting Western military power and forcing the U.S. and its allies to defend multiple theaters simultaneously.
So to summarize all this for you, the listener, technology has fundamentally erased the old boundaries of conflict.
Completely. We have Coast Guard ships acting as blockade fleets. We have drones delivering robots to the front lines. And we have everyday consumer electronics being weaponized for international espionage.
Which leaves us with a final thought to mull over. If an AI drone can autonomously fight a war on a beach in Europe, and the doorbell on your front porch can be quietly drafted as an international spy, where exactly does the civilian world end and the military battlefield begin?
It is a sobering question.
It really is. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the open source intelligence. We will catch you next time on The Lowdown.